interesting question came up that someone asked me to kind of share with the rest of you, a provocative question. I'm going to hit that. Then I'm going to give you a new scientific discovery. It's all over the news. It's been on radio, TV, and all over the web. Talk a little bit about that. And then a brief field report, and it really ties into the lesson we were talking about last week. And then we'll get into Job 38 and integrating that with Psalm 104 and Proverbs chapter 8. Well, the question that came up at the end of class last time, and we have a little group around here at the end of class as we usually do, and the issue that came up, I happened to drop out the statement, this is the only time in cosmic history in which we can see the cosmic background radiation. It's the only time in cosmic history in which you can directly witness the creation event. And so I'm going to explain to you how that works. Okay. Up until now, the universe has been expanding at less than the velocity of light. Okay? Because, as the universe is created, it's created with the property of expansion. It tells us that 11 different places in the Bible, God continuously stretches out the heavens. However, gravity works to slow down the cosmic expansion. So the bits and pieces of matter in the universe attract one another, and that acts as a brake on the expansion of the universe. And so the universe would be expanding at less than the velocity of light. However, as the universe gets older and older, it gets bigger and bigger. And the bigger it gets, the weaker gravity becomes in its capacity to slow down the cosmic expansion. And so the slowing down effect becomes less and less as the universe ages. And then dark energy kicks in. This is this new discovery. It was the greatest discovery of 2003, according to Science Magazine. And this is the dominant feature in the universe, more dominant than the matter. It's about twice as dominant as the matter term in the universe. And this is the energy that's embedded in the space fabric of the universe. And you've heard me explain before, it works like an anti-elastic band. The more you stretch it, the more energy it gains to accelerate the expansion of the universe. Now, when the universe is young and therefore small, the self-stretching property of the universe is weak in its capacity to accelerate the expansion of the universe. But as the universe gets older and older, then this dark energy becomes more and more powerful in its capacity to accelerate cosmic expansion. And astronomers have been able to measure both the matter term and the dark energy term rather accurately in 2003 by several independent tools. And what we now understand is that for the first 9 billion years of its history, the universe was slowing down in its expansion. For the past 5 billion years, it's been speeding up. But the net result is, as the universe does expand, we reach this point where it transitions from slowing down in its expansion to speeding up. But until the present moment, the most distant parts of the universe have been moving away from one another at less than the velocity of light. Right now, it's half the velocity of light. And it takes this much time for light from the most distant objects in the universe to reach us. It's taken time for the light to travel through space so it actually can reach our point of view. So if we were created any earlier in cosmic history, light from the most distant objects in the universe would not have had adequate time to reach us. And therefore, astronomers living in the distant past of cosmic history would not have been able to see the radiation from the creation event. They would only have been able to see the late developments of the universe, not the early developments. Now, there's a problem with the future, because in the future, the most distant objects will be moving at greater than the velocity of light. When they move greater than the velocity of light, Einstein's theory of relativity tells us they'll become invisible. And so from now on, astronomers are going to notice that more and more objects in the universe become invisible to us because they're moving away from us at greater than the velocity of light. The only time in cosmic history in which you can see the most distant objects in the universe and look all the way back to the creation event itself is when that most distant part of the universe is expanding at exactly the velocity of light. And that's the epoch in which we currently live. Any earlier, it's less than the velocity of light, which means light hasn't had time to catch up. and any later means that the most distant objects are moving at greater than the velocity of light and they become invisible. So only 13.7 billion years after the creation event do you actually get a window where you can see the entire history of the universe. Therefore, when you read in the Bible here that the heavens declare the glory of God, they declare His power, they declare His righteousness, they declare His love, you can find scriptures that say all four of those things. We've been actually looking at some of them as we go through the 20 major creation accounts. That is because we're in a position, a unique time in cosmic history, when we can actually observe enough of the universe to see those characteristics of the universe brought out. In fact, if it wasn't for our ability to witness the radiation from the creation event, we really wouldn't be able to come up with these powerful theorems that establish that a causal agent must exist independent of matter, energy, space, and time. Also, it's true if we weren't in the place that we are. 99.99999% of the volume of our galaxy, you would not be able to see the cosmic background radiation. It's because of where the sun is and its orbit around the center of the galaxy, halfway up in the center of the galaxy, in between two spiral arms, with no nearby globular clusters, our view is not blocked. There's not the gas, the dust, and the nearby stars that would typically block your view. And of course, the challenge to the atheists, we're talking about apologetics earlier, this is a new reason you can give people to believe. How do you explain the fact that we human beings happen to be at the ideal moment in cosmic history to be witnesses, direct witnesses to creation, and at the ideal location? Change the location ever so slightly, or the time ever so slightly, we would not be able to directly witness the creation of the universe and therefore get a direct scientific measurement on exactly what is the causal agent behind it all. So that's why this is so great and wonderful. Yes. When the most distant objects in the universe, because to get a picture of this, think of blowing up a balloon, because you know all the stars and galaxies are on the surface of the universe. So if you think of an analogy, you blow up a balloon, put dots on the surface of the balloon, dots that are close together as the balloon is being blown up will move apart from one another slowly, but dots that are far apart in the balloon will move apart from one another rapidly. And so when we look at the Andromeda Galaxy, for example, the expansion of the universe is barely perceptible in its velocity profile. It's just too close. But as you look at the most distant galaxies, we see that they're moving at 90% the velocity of light relative to us. And then the radiation from the creation event is moving at the velocity of light, virtually at the velocity of light. Right. Okay, Einstein's theory of relativity tells us that nothing can be accelerated past the velocity of light in the absence of a dark energy term. Because, you know, originally it was presumed that the universe did not have a dark energy term. Only in 1999 did astronomers discover that there indeed was a dark energy term. And the reason, I mean, just think of it this way. What you're doing is you're expanding the surface of the universe. It's like you're expanding the surface of the balloon. And it's a geometric thing that you're expanding. And because it's purely geometry, mathematics, it can be expanded at faster than the velocity of light. So there's nothing preventing the surface of the universe from expanding at greater than the velocity of light. And if it expands at greater than the velocity of light, it's going to carry objects on that surface relative to one another at greater than the velocity of light. But if that term is zero, if there's no built-in acceleration of the space surface of the universe, then it is true, nothing in a vacuum can move at greater than the velocity of light. Now, I'll give you one more analogy to show you how it works. An ocean wave crashing on the beach of Newport cannot move at greater than the velocity of light. It's a physical amount of water. Water is limited by how fast it can move. However, the crest of the wave could move at greater than the velocity of light. It's a mathematical point. For example, you can consider this to be the surface of the Earth, probably the contact between the water and the beach at Newport Beach. And here's a wave, the crest of a wave coming in, but it comes in at an angle. Instead of coming directly in, it comes in at an angle like this. and the wave is moving towards the beach at 3 miles an hour. However, what I'm going to do is measure that point where the crest of the wave makes contact with the shore of the beach. So in this analogy, I really need three hands here to make this work. It would be that point right there. And what I can do is arbitrarily make this angle very, very small. And the smaller I make that angle, the more rapidly that point will move across the shore of the beach. It's a scissor analogy, exactly. And so I can make that mathematical point move at 10 times the velocity of light, even though the ocean wave is only moving at 3 miles per hour. So similarly, as we're expanding the space surface of the universe, it's carrying space with it. So the space is being stretched. And if it's being stretched, it'll carry stuff with it. So yeah, in that sense, as we look forward to the future, we're looking at a rather dismal situation in which we're going to be condemned to see less and less of the universe as time marches forward. This is the only moment in cosmic history when you can see everything. How long is that epic? Well, it's going to last for a while. I mean, we're talking on a time scale of billions of years, and so there is a window, probably a few million years wide, where everything is just ideal. But we have to be created right smack in that window. So this is the best time. Yeah. Well, again, we're talking over a scale of a few million years as compared to 14 billion years. And I don't know if any of my colleagues have actually calculated precisely where that window is. Part of the reason why we don't do that, it depends a little bit on the model, the hot Big Bang model that you choose to describe the geometry of the universe. There are about three different classes of Big Bang models, all with very slightly different geometrical features. And those slightly different geometrical features will give you different answers to your question. Just so that you know, the three competing models for the universe are what's called the hot Big Bang inflationary model, where the universe hyperinflates when it's extremely young at many times the velocity of light, and then goes into a normal expansion of the universe thereafter. That happens when the universe is a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old, and just for a split second. That's one model of the universe. Another model of the universe is that it's a 10-dimensional flat sheet that folds in on itself and makes a U, like that, with one 10-dimensional sheet facing the other 10-dimensional sheet. And then the other model of the universe that's in the running is that the universe is a 12-sided, it's a duodecahedron, so it's a closed surface. The two models, the hot Big Bang inflationary model and the ekpyrotic model, that's this model that's folded like that, those are open universe models where the lines of space go to infinity. But a competing model says that it's a closed surface, a lot like a soccer ball, with 12 flat 10-dimensional sheets connected together with one another. And depending which model you choose, you get a slightly different answer to your question. But the good news is, within probably 4 or 5 years, we'll know which of those three classes of model is correct, because those three different models predict slightly different propagation of gravity waves in the universe. And we're at the verge of being able to detect those gravity waves. There's two telescopes in operation now that would have that capacity. As soon as the next two black holes merge together within, say, 50 million light years of us. You know, that happens about once every couple of years. So the next time that takes place, we'll get the gravity waves. Of course, the big hope is it doesn't happen too close to us, because that will wipe out humanity. But gravity waves are weak, so you need really big events to take place in order to detect them. Yes. Well, dark energy is really already proven to exist. 1999 is when astronomers detected it for the first time in a way that was unambiguous, and that was the greatest discovery for 1999, was its detection. But it was detected at about a plus or minus 20% level, which isn't enough to really nail down these kinds of detailed models of the universe. The breakthrough discovery of 2003 was that dark energy for the first time had been measured to 1% precision and has been determined by four different independent measuring methods. So let's really put it beyond doubt. We really do live in a universe with a dark energy term. You know, and this is exciting as from a Christian perspective, because there have been a number of atheist astrophysicists who have said this dark energy term has got to be wrong, because if it's right, then we're faced with this external causal agent that performs miracles for reasons of his own. And the point there is, what they're alluding to is the fact that in dark energy, we have the most profound design evidence in any of the sciences. I mean, I've discussed this before in the class. For those of you that are new, the level of design exceeds 1 part in 10 to the 120th. That's 120 zeros after the 1. To put that in some kind of context, if you were to fill the entire universe with dimes packed tight, that adds up to 10 to the 83 dimes. So the level of fine-tuning here is far greater than your chance of picking out one dime out of a pile that fills the entire universe. I mean, by billions of times. Okay. Any more questions? Yes. This dark energy is called dark energy because it emits no light or heat. So you can't see it shining in the cosmos. However, we do see its influence. Dark energy, because it's expanding universe or expanding the surface of the universe, adds another feature to the dynamics of galaxies relating to one another. In fact, that's how it's discovered. They tried to work out the mechanics, the dynamics of galaxies interacting with one another on the assumption that gravity was the only factor. And they discovered that it was not adequate. There was something that was causing these galaxies to move away from one another much greater than what we'd expect if gravity was the only factor. And so that's what this dark energy is. And they've been able to measure it quite carefully and determine that indeed this must be something that affects the entire physical universe from the creation event forward. And it's a self-stretching property of the surface. That's the only theory that gives us the right numbers with respect to the observations that are taking place. So, by the way, in our creation update program this coming Tuesday, we'll be describing a brand new discovery in dark energy. A group of astronomers has been able to determine whether or not this dark energy is constant for the entire age of the universe, or whether there's a very tiny variation of it in the early history of the universe. So we'll be talking about that on our Creation Update webcast show on Tuesday, and the implications of that in terms of building a more impressive biblical creation model. Okay, the discovery I was going to talk to you about, the Spitzer Space Telescope. Thanks to the generosity of your tax dollars, there have been 4 telescopes sent up into outer space that are like the equivalent of the Hubble Space Telescope. Hubble Space Telescope is that instrument that's taking all these beautiful pictures at visual and ultraviolet wavelengths. There's also an X-ray telescope that NASA sent up, first-class X-ray telescope, a gamma-ray telescope, and then there's this infrared telescope, the Spitzer Space Telescope. And all over the web and on radio and TV this weekend has been the announcement that the Spitzer telescope has been looking at stars in the constellation Taurus, and they're finding these dusty disks around these young stellar objects. These are stars that are not yet fully formed. They're on the way to becoming stars. And they found gaps in these disks which tell them that planets are already forming. And they kind of got a little bit ahead of themselves in saying this establishes a planetary formation, takes place very early in the formation of stars, hundreds of thousands of years rather than millions of years, and therefore that planets are much more common than what we thought. And then what really got the news media excited is that they found in these dusty disks a whole lot of hydrocarbons, basically sticky hydrocarbons. Technical name is polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. A less technical name is that sticky goo on your barbecue grill. Okay? That this stuff is fairly ubiquitous, and within these sticky hydrocarbons are about 120 of the simple molecules that are, quote, the building blocks of life. And so the bottom line announcement was, this proves that life is common throughout the universe. Okay. Now, if you go to the NASA website, it was a little more circumspect. It didn't quite make all those claims, but that's how it came across on radio and TV. So, but I do appreciate that NASA was a little more cautious about this. By the way, this isn't terribly new. This is simply confirming what astrophysicists have already been calculating through their detailed models of how stars and planets form. And when they say that the planets form quickly, this is entirely expected in that there's a region around forming stars. And by the way, this is only true of late-born stars. Early-born stars, the 98% of the stars in the universe you would classify as early-born. Early-born stars are born at an epoch in the history of the universe where there's not yet enough heavy elements made by star burning to get these hydrocarbons. And it's only late-born stars. Our star is a late-born star. It was born just 4.5 billion years ago. And these are stars that are quite a bit younger than that again. And so the younger the star, the greater the amount of these heavy elements, and therefore it's no big deal that as we look at these young stellar objects, they have lots of dust and dirt and rocks going around them. But there's a region around each star where you have a high probability that these sticky hydrocarbons will form. And you need about a temperature of 1,000 degrees centigrade above absolute zero for that to take place. And in the case of our solar system, that's that region between Mars and Jupiter. And this is where you get comets and asteroids forming early history. And so long before this was published, not long before, 3 months before this was published, that's a long time for astronomical research, detailed models form which establish that around every young star where you got these heavy elements, you're going to get a zone where you have these polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and that's not going to lead to the formation of planets, but it will lead to the formation of asteroids and comets, and they will form first. And this is comforting because as we make careful measurements of the ages of the planets and comets and meteorites and asteroids in our solar system, the oldest objects are the asteroids and the comets. They're older than the planets. But it's no big deal because they're made up of these sticky hydrocarbons, and that's the stuff that's going to coagulate most easily and quite rapidly. In hundreds of thousands of years, is right in the ballpark of what we expected. But that doesn't prove that planets, therefore, are common, because once you get outside that 1,000-degree centigrade zone, then you don't have these sticky hydrocarbons, and you've got much less efficient, slower mechanisms and process that will lead to planets, but not as many as you would otherwise think, and you will not get them forming quite so quickly. But as a big bonus, you get bigger ones. So where you got the sticky hydrocarbons, you're going to get things happening quickly, efficiently, but it's going to be small stuff. It's not going to be big stuff. And you need big stuff if you want to have life existing. And then in terms of the hydrocarbons they're finding, it's true. They found 120 different hydrocarbons in these clouds, in these dust bands. But it's totally irrelevant to the origin of life. What we're finding there are alcohols. We're finding hydrogen cyanide. We're finding things like carbon monoxide, a little tiny amount of carbon dioxide, lots of water. And they have found one case where they think it's simply possible, it's not probable, they may have found glycine. Glycine is the simplest of the amino acids that make up the proteins. I think it's got 14 atoms in it total. So it's not a very complex molecule, and there's not even a positive identification there. So these 120 hydrocarbons, you can have them percolate for the entire age of the universe, over the whole of the universe, you're not going to get anything. In these clouds, they have yet to find any sugars. They have yet to find any nucleotides. And at best, they have found just glycine at an extremely low abundance, but even that is not a positive identification. And by the way, there's a problem if you've got too much of these volatile hydrocarbons. That was the blessing of planet Earth. Planet Earth formed with a huge amount of water, a huge amount of these gaseous hydrocarbons, and that would have been deadly for the possibility of future life on planet Earth. And thank God we had this collision take place with this Mars-sized body when the Earth was only 50 to 60 million years old, and that rid the Earth of too much water. So have you ever saw that movie Waterworld? Too much water can be a bad thing. Too many volatiles can be a bad thing. You've got too many volatiles, you'll not get the atmosphere that you need for the support of life. That's the problem with Uranus and Neptune and Jupiter and Saturn. They got way too many of these hydrocarbons in their atmosphere, and that's poisonous for life. Methane and ammonia in particular are deadly. You don't want that stuff lying around. But Earth was blessed with a collision that got rid of all these volatiles and prevented us having this enormous ocean. So bottom line is, unlike what you're hearing on radio and TV, this is no encouragement whatsoever for the origin of life problem. You've got a book there on the origin of life. By the way, everything that's in this discovery was anticipated in our book. That's one thing I looked at. I said, gee, I wonder if we got everything covered here. But it's fortunately, the book was, they let us update it right up to the last minute, and all that stuff is in there. Okay, let me segue to Job. Oh, by the way, a little announcement. I was on the radio yesterday for an hour and a half in the state of Indiana, and we got some coverage in Illinois and other places too. We're on about a dozen radio stations. And this class was a real blessing. I didn't realize it, but the radio talk show host was a young earth creationist, and he was trying to, quote, trap me. In fact, he told the audience, I'm going to stump Dr. Ross. And for an hour and a half, he tried to stump me. But, you know, the questions he asked is all stuff we've been covering these past few weeks in class. It was really quite remarkable. So I want to thank all of you for the input and discussion and questions that you've been asking, because it was virtually the same as what I had to deal with last night. Well, if you recall, Monday night I did get stumped, remember? Somebody asked me about the last part of Ezekiel, and I had to say, look, I don't really have a good understanding of what that's all about. So I do get stumped on occasion. But thanks to your help, I did not get stumped last night. And what he was really trying to stump me on was this whole idea that there's no doubt that the Bible teaches that the flood was global in extent. And I says, well, you know, you need to look at Job 38 and Psalm 104 and Proverbs chapter 8. And, you know, because I had my Bible there, I was able to flip. I mean, I had it all marked for this morning. So I was able to flip right to the passages. And he says, do you have those things memorized? And I says, no, but I got this Sunday school class. So. And he started asking me questions about the class that I teach. So we got a lot of publicity throughout Indiana and Illinois about the class and all the fun things we do here and talk about these kinds of issues where we try to, quote, stump one another. And that's kind of fun because we do try to bring up issues in this class that really do prepare us to deal with the skeptics. And that's what I liked about Monday night. We have some really good skeptics from all different perspectives coming up to the microphone. So it was a wonderful time. Yes. He had me on once before, about a couple of years ago, with a UFO book. He's really into UFOs and extraterrestrial life. And he said, well, I couldn't stump Dr. Ross back then, and I haven't been able to do it today. He's going to keep trying. In fact, he wants me back on. He's got some other things he thinks he can stump me on, so we'll see. And maybe he will. I mean, it's okay to be stumped on occasion. That's how we learn things. I mean, you people here in the class ask me questions that get me stumped, and it forces me to kind of dig into it. Although I don't think I'm ever going to make that much headway in the last 8 chapters of Ezekiel. It's just the way that text is put together. So, but one of the things we did discuss on the air last night was the fact that Genesis 1 is not the only creation account in the Bible that takes us through the physical events of creation. You know, one of the things I've been encouraging you to do is just look at our current text. By the way, for those of you that are new, what we're doing is purposely going through the 20 major creation accounts in the Bible. And we've been through the three that are in Genesis 1 through Genesis 11. And then we looked at Job chapter 9. That's the second creation account. Then we're looking at this rather lengthy creation account that goes from Job 34 through to Job 41. And we're in the 38th chapter. And when you get to the 38th chapter, this is the first time that the Lord actually addresses the five men. I mean, here's these five men debating one another for probably what went on for several weeks. And finally, the Lord decides to interrupt this debate, and he begins to speak. But what you see in Job 38, and the Lord is going to speak for several chapters, but as he opens up his address to these five men, he basically reviews the events of Genesis chapter 1. Now, it's poetry, and this is something we need to recognize because we're looking at the poetic passages. Job is a poetry, Psalm 104 is poetry, and likewise Proverbs chapter 8. Because it's poetry, we shouldn't expect it to be laid out in the strict chronology that we see in Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2. And so one of the things I'm trying to encourage you to do as we go through Job 38 and the other poetic passages we'll be picking up is to go through the text and see if you can find the clues that reference you to the six creation days. But don't expect it to be laid out as three sentences on day one, and then three sentences on day two, three sentences on day three, four, five, six. I mean, that's not the way it's done. It's going to bounce around a bit. And we've already had some exercise in looking at it, Elihu's address, or Elihu will raise questions, and then he'll answer it like eight, nine verses later. And so if you're looking, as most English readers do, and trying to find a strict chronological sequence, you can miss a lot. And this is the thing that was rather exciting talking to this talk show host last night. He says, "No, I never saw this in the text. I never really saw this kind of pattern going on here." And it's because we're looking for too strict a chronological pattern. That's not the way poetry is laid out. In fact, even English poetry has that characteristic. Now, we've got some people taking linguistics here in the class, and they can bring that out. That's the way things work. However, just to give you kind of a quick outline of what's happening in Job 38, you've got verses 4 through 7, which really reflect on creation days 1 and 2 in Genesis 1. And then verse 8 to 11, which is the passage I read in the air last night, that's the one that deals with creation day 3 and reflects directly on what's happening in the Genesis flood. And then verses 12 through to about 15 is day 4. Verses 16 and following is day 5. And the problem here is every once in a while, especially when you get down to verses 12 and following, events that pertain to creation day 4 and 5 is brought up, then the Lord is making certain apologetic points, and he's asking questions. And, you know, poetry lends itself to that. You can just kind of stop your flow and, you know, change the subject, ask a question, make a point, and keep right on moving. And that's kind of how it's laid out here. And so as you go from verse 16 down to about verse 24, the reference to creation day 5 keeps coming up. There's also reflections that take you back to creation day 1 and creation day 3. Creation day 6 really doesn't get addressed to the very end of Job 38. As you go from verse 25 down to verse 36, you've got constant references to day 4 and day 1. And by the way, this is where people who hold the framework hypothesis get some of their ammunition. You know, the framework hypothesis is those individuals, those scholars, who look at Genesis 1 as a triad, where day 1 and day 4 are connected, day 2 and day 5 are connected, and day 3 and day 6 are connected. You know, and there's some validity for that. You know, creation day 1 talks about light. Creation day 4 also talks about light. Creation day 2 talks about the atmosphere and the water. And creation day 5 talks about God creating creatures within the water. So there is this parallelism that takes place there. And creation day 3 talks about land plants, and creation day 6 talks about land animals. So there is some validity to what the framework hypothesis is saying here. But they try to claim that proves that the text doesn't have a strict chronology. That's where I would part company from the framework hypothesis. I would say, you're right that this poetic tool is being used, and there's this parallel structure here which is communicating something to us, but that doesn't mean there's no chronology. But where they try to make their point is they go to places like Job 38 and they make the point, notice that you're getting the same parallelism being brought up again, and I would have to agree, you do get the same parallelism brought up again. They also say, notice that Job 38 is not strictly chronological. And I would say you're right, but that doesn't prove that Genesis chapter 1 is not strictly chronological. And by the way, when we get to Psalm 104, the chronology is a lot more parallel to Genesis 1 than this text is. This is not the most parallel poetic text we're going to be running into. Proverbs 8 is a little more parallel than this text, and Psalm 104 is virtually a restatement of Genesis chapter 1. But what's interesting about these three texts, Job 38, Proverbs 8, and Psalm 104, is that they're adding a lot of scientific detail that's not present in Genesis 1. Genesis 1 is the first creation account, and I believe it does follow a chronology, a strict chronology, and that God is giving us the highlights of what he did in physical creation, and on purpose is condensing it to a single page. These are the most significant things God has performed to prepare planet Earth for human beings. But in these additional creation accounts, he fleshes out a lot of the details that where there wasn't adequate room to squeeze them in to Genesis chapter 1. And so that's kind of what we're going to be doing here in Job 38, is picking up details that were not mentioned in Genesis chapter 1. And of course, the real key to this is you want to integrate all the poetic passages with Genesis 1. And this is a theme I tried to bring out in the radio show last night, because this gentleman has had a number of the men on his show that take special pleasure in attacking Reasons to Believe, and me in particular. And so I just kept emphasizing, there's no need for all this hostility. There's no need for all this dispute and fighting. God has blessed us with 20 different creation accounts. We can settle our disputes. We can get rid of the hostility by simply looking at all the creation of texts and insisting that we take them all literally, but also take them consistently. That if we find our interpretation of Job 38 contradicting our interpretation of Proverbs 8, we know we've made a mistake. They all have to fit together. And if we do that, then there's no need for all this hostility and infighting in the Christian community. I saw a hand back there. Yes. Oh, it was called The Edge. It comes out of Indianapolis. And it's a syndicated show, so there's stations across Indiana, Illinois, Ohio that pick it up. Saturday night is when they broadcast. And so it's not broadcast in California, but it is up on the web. And he did say that he's going to give us permission to put it on our website, so we will put it up on our website. Yes. A gentleman by the name of Daniel Ott, O-T-T, is the host. So the website is The Edge AM. So, and you can see he covers all kinds of subjects. And he told me he purposely likes to get people in the show that disagree with him. So it was a very friendly discussion. He was not at all hostile towards me. He just kept trying to, quote, stump me with his issues and his questions. We talked about radiometric dating. We talked about the Big Bang, the Grand Canyon, Genesis Flood, who created God, ekpyrotic model of the universe that we were talking about earlier. We wanted to talk about that. Well, he's been to our website, so he kind of knows all the hot issues we deal with. Origin of life, origin of the universe. He even wanted to talk about end times prophecy, the meaning of the word Yom in Genesis 1, UFOs, extraterrestrials, extinctions, dinosaurs, speciation. We had an hour and a half, so got to cover a lot of stuff. So... but yeah, we will be putting it up on our website, so if you want to hear it, you can do that. Okay. Did I get the question or not? I don't know whether I answered it fully. I did. Okay. Moving on. Okay. What we're looking at last week is how there's probably the issue of greatest dispute, and this is something that Daniel Ott agreed with me. He says, of all the creation issues that Christians fight over, probably the extent of the Genesis flood is at the top of the list. And that's actually historically accurate. In terms of this young earth, old earth dispute, in terms of how we interpret the creation accounts of the Bible, it actually has its roots in what's called flood geology. So long before you had young earth creationists, you had people in the early part of the 20th century trying to promote this idea that the flood of Genesis was global in extent, and out of that was born the young earth movement. So the flood stuff comes first. And you even see that in the writings of Henry Morris. The first book he brought out was called The Genesis Flood. and then he built his young Earth model on top of that. Well, one of the things I had a chance to share with Daniel Ott is, you know, we can fight over the meaning and interpretation of Genesis 6, 7, 8, and 9, but maybe the best way to settle this is go to Job 38, Psalm 104, Proverbs 8, and you get a New Testament passage, which is 2 Peter 3. Now, what it tells us here in the text, Job 38, who shut up the sea behind doors when it burst forth from the womb, when I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness, when I fixed limits for it and set its doors and bars in place, when I said, this far you may come and no farther, here is where your proud waves halt. And the comment I made last week that this is a reference to creation days 2 and 3. You know, it talks about the clouds, talks about the garment, and by the way, one area of dispute over Genesis 1, is it really true that when God created the earth, that it was dark on the surface of the waters with light outside, but not light inside? Now, some people interpret Genesis 1 that there was no light at all in the universe until creation day 1, whereas I prefer the interpretation that when God created the universe, there was energy in the universe, there was light in the universe, but it was dark on the surface of the waters. And what we see here in verse 9 is that it does support that interpretation. It talks about when God put clouds over the face of the earth and wrapped the surface of the earth as a garment and clothed it in darkness. So this is making a direct reference to the fact that indeed the primordial atmosphere of planet Earth was opaque to light. There was light, but it couldn't get through to the surface of the waters. And what you see in creation day 1, verse 3, let there be light. Doesn't say that God created the light, it says let the light be. And so the light for the first time is able to get through this garment, this atmosphere, and instead of the surface of the earth being wrapped in darkness by the clouds now become translucent to light. So light is able to pass through, and it doesn't become transparent until creation day 4. And I think there's enough in here to persuade you that this is indeed a reference to creation days 2 and 3. And you say, well, maybe I'm not convinced. That's what happened to Daniel Lott. He says, look, I'm not persuaded by this. And I says, well, let's turn over to Psalm 104. Let's turn over to Proverbs 8 and see if this is supported. And for that matter, let's back up a little bit and see what we get in verses 4, 5, 6, and 7. What does it say there? Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? So God is addressing these five men, saying, you guys have had this long debate running probably for several weeks. You think you're so smart, but let me ask you a question. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Sure do you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? Or what were its footings, on what were its footings set? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy. So he's making the point, look, the angels watching me do this, but you weren't there. You were created much later. And you don't know what I did back then. But I would argue that the laying of the earth's foundations, marking off its dimensions, measuring a line across it, setting its footings, is a direct reference to what we see in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, 3, 4, and 5. Yes. Well, most scholars argue that the morning stars is a reference to the angels. Now, it is a technical astronomical term. When you talk to an astronomer about morning stars, he'll say that's Mercury and Venus, because those are the bright morning stars. The property of looking at Mercury and Venus is that they're much brighter when you see them in the morning than when you see them in the evening. And so Venus, for example, is called the bright morning star. But if you look at it when it's closest to the earth and up in the morning sky, you can actually read a newspaper by it, whereas in the evening it's much dimmer. No, no. I mean, because what you'll see in Revelation chapter 1, it actually defines as a symbol definition. The angels are stars. So, you know, I take the point of view, do not adopt a symbol in the Bible unless it's defined somewhere in the Bible. But Revelation 1, and there's an Old Testament references too, do define the stars as a symbol for the angels. So, and then, you know, he's obviously referring to something that's got personality. On what works footing set, or who laid its cornerstones, while the morning stars sang together, and all the angels shouted for joy. So, morning stars would be angels or higher angels. And this is the one place in the Bible you can go to address the question, when did God create the angels? By the way, this is the only verse in the Bible you can go to get any insight in that question. Nowhere else in the Bible does it give you a clue as to when God created the angels. And this doesn't tell you that much either, but what it does tell you is that the angels were witnesses to God laying the foundations of the earth. So they must have been present 4.5 billion years ago. Now, does that mean that they were here when God created the universe? Maybe, but not necessarily. They were certainly here when God laid the foundations of the earth. It's possible they were created even before the universe. You know, God may have had this spiritual creation and then said, okay, watch what I'm going to do. He creates the angels first. He wanted them to be witnesses to what's going on here. But they were there that far back. But also argue this is establishing, and by the way, I don't see scholars disputing this. Every Bible scholar that I've looked at in terms of a commentary in Job does agree that the angels themselves were here when God laid the initial foundations of the earth. That being the case, verses 4, 5, 6, and 7, I think, are unarguably a reference to creation day 1 and maybe the events before creation day 1. Which gives you stronger support that when you move into verses 8, 9, 10, and 11, that it's a reference to creation days 2 and 3. And then you move on to verse 12, and it talks about events that would coincide with creation day 4, verse 16, 5. I think you can build a case here. This really is paralleling what we're seeing here in Genesis chapter 1. But let me flip you over to Psalm 104. Because in Psalm 104, you get a much tighter parallel and much more detailed description. It's a much longer passage. It's about twice as long as Job 38. And whereas Job 38 has got other purposes than simply reflecting on Genesis chapter 1, as you go through Psalm 104, this seems to be the only purpose of the psalm. Well, other than the fact that God is great and marvelous and glorious, and the heavens declare the marvel of God, and creation declares the power of God, really, the focus of Psalm 104 is to give you a detailed reflection on Genesis chapter 1. Whereas Job 38, God's also interrupting and asking questions and trying to minister to these five men. There's none of that content in Psalm 104. So we should expect that in reading Psalm 104, we're going to get a tighter text dealing with these physical events of creation. And we would expect that the creation days would be more tightly laid out. In fact, you usually get one or two full paragraphs dealing with each of the creation days. So that's an exercise we're going to go to when we get to Psalm 104. But once again, you drop down to verse 5. By the way, it starts off in the very beginning with a reference to the universe. It says, O Lord my God, you are very great. You are clothed with splendor and majesty. He wraps himself in light as with a garment. He stretches out the heavens like a tent. So this is one of those references in the Bible where God is expanding the universe from the moment of creation onwards, like one would expand out a tent. And that's also interesting from my perspective as an astronomer, because it's using a two-dimensional word picture, and that's what we see in the case of the universe. The tent is three dimensions, but he's making a reference to the surface of the tent. In the case of God expanding universe, the universe has got four large dimensions, and the stuff that really has meaning and content, physical content for us, is on the surface of the universe, just like a tent. Lays the beams of his upper chambers on their waters. He makes the clouds his chariot and rides on the wings of the wind. So here's a reference to creation day 2. He makes winds his messengers, flames of fire his servants. And there's been a lot of dispute over what this means. It could be tying in to Job 38, because winds and messengers are symbols that are used for angels. So this is another place to go and say, aha, maybe what the psalmist here is trying to do is take you back to Job 38, which would be another piece of evidence that this is meant to be a parallel passage to Job 38. Okay, where it gets into creation day 3, it says he sets the earth on its foundations, it can never be moved. Again, you see that same word picture being used in Job 38 that prefaces the statement with respect to creation day 3. says, "You covered it. You covered the earth with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. But at your rebuke, the waters fled. At the sound of your thunder, they took to flight. They flowed over the mountains. They went down into the valleys to the place you find for them. You set a boundary they cannot cross. Never again will they cover the earth." You know, and this is something that Daniel had never really appreciated before, that you've got a text here, obviously referring to creation day two, but making the point that when God sets up these boundaries, these continents, these islands, that never again would the water cover the whole face of the earth, and therefore the Genesis flood could not be global in extent. Yes. Well, he was aware, because he's had a number of younger creationists on his show, that younger creationists try to claim that this psalm has got nothing to do with Genesis chapter 1, and therefore referring just to the flood event and not to creation day 2. But the point I was making with Daniel Lott, that's really difficult to sustain if you read all of Psalm 104, because you just see these obvious reference points to all six of the creation days. And likewise, when you cross-reference it with Proverbs 8 and Psalm or Job 38, you again see these obvious connections. There are things here in Psalm 104 that reflect the language of Job 38 and Proverbs 8. And therefore, when you put the whole case together, it's really indefensible to say this has got nothing whatsoever to do with Genesis 1. And that's something he said he had never really appreciated before, is just going through all that and seeing how that works out. Then he asked me questions like, then how far do you think humanity had spread over the earth? And I said, we'll go back to Genesis chapter 11. And what you notice is in Genesis 1, Genesis 9, and Genesis 11, God's struggle with humanity is their refusal to fill the earth. So that's a clear reference that in the days before the flood, humanity had not become global. And if humanity had not become global, there's no need to wipe out the polar bears and the emperor penguins. You can leave Antarctica alone. There's no sin in Antarctica. People haven't gone there yet. And therefore, the emperor penguins are not going to be negatively impacted by human sin. But things are different in Mesopotamia. And when you go to Genesis 11, it's quite clear that humanity was really very rebellious in refusing to obey God's command to multiply and fill the earth. We will not do what God has commanded. We're going to stay in one place. We're going to build this city, and we're going to build this tower so that we will not be scattered over the face of the earth. And God says, that's not good. And he forcibly scatters humanity over the face of the earth. And then Daniel and I talked a lot about the evidence scientifically for this rapid migration of humanity out of Mesopotamia to all the places. And he actually got quite excited about that. He says, wow, you know, this is, he wasn't again aware of the scientific evidence that supports this rapid migration of humanity throughout all the continental land masses. Yeah, Charlie. Well, I would argue that's a powerful apologetic tool, that the scriptures here have to be supernaturally inspired. Because, yeah, these people are living thousands of years apart from one another. They don't know one another. And yet you see these, and, you know, keep in mind what you see in 1 Peter, where it talks about these prophets of old writing these scriptures and longing to understand what they had read, but had to recognize that the Holy Spirit inspired them so that a future generation would understand what they were writing. So clearly, according to Peter, the prophets of God that wrote these psalms, that wrote Job, and you know, Proverbs and Genesis, didn't understand what they were writing. I don't know. Probably not. And yet when you cross-reference them, it's quite clear that you're getting the same pictures there. So that would be a proof that you could go to, that there must be a common inspirer of these passages. Otherwise, how can you, you know, explain these very tight cross-references that you see here in the text? And the references that people living thousands of years ago wouldn't pick up. We would pick them up because we got a lot of hindsight. Right. Yeah, well, that's what we're going to get into. I see that I'm out of time. I was really hoping I could finish this today, but that's the way it goes. But there's a lot more in here than just a reflection on Genesis 1. And again, that's where I have to tip my hat to the framework people and say, you guys have got a point. There are these parallel structures going on, and God is trying to give us a message that's heavenly as well as earthly. What I want to do is focus on the earthly part first, because that's where all the dispute is. That's kind of the way Christians are. We fight over the things that are concrete that should be easy to settle, and we let go all the tough stuff. But we'll get into the tough stuff as well. So with that, keep reading in the text here. And I'm going to ask you, just for homework, those of you who've got time, to go through Job 38 and to see if you can pick up all the references to the six creation day events in Genesis chapter 1. But I'll give you a little summary here of what you can get when you integrate Proverbs 8, Job 38, and Psalm 104. In preparing earth for the eventual creation of humans, God established, quote, a boundary, quote, fixed limits, or doors and bars. Those are phrases I picked from all three creation texts. For the oceans, that the waters cannot overstep and will not overstep from that point onward. Okay? So here's an easy place you can go to settle a big problem that Christians have. And by the way, we're not just studying this because Christians fight over this passage. It's because non-Christians are very sensitive to Christian infighting, and they like to take advantage of that to ignore our apologetic message. And so you can expect that non-Christians will have heard of these things and love to try to split us apart so that they can ignore the more important message. Yes. I would say it works both ways, that theology has a real hand in supporting our understanding of what's out there in the general revelation, the created realm. And likewise, what we see in the created realm can really help crystallize our understanding of what's going on as we look at the special revelation. It's all from God. People say, why is God so superfluous in giving us 20 different creation accounts? And why, on top of that, does he add this record of nature we can see back to the creation event? It's because we're thick-headed and we're rebellious. So God's got to tell us several times in several different ways. And also, God wants us to come to peace and resolution with one another. So I feel he's given us the tools in advance to build that peace and resolution. And really, my favorite apologetics text of all, and often apologists don't quote the whole verse, but I'll quote you the whole verse, 1 Peter 3:15. Always be ready to give an answer for the hope within you with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience. It's not enough to give reasons to believe. What counts is how you give those reasons to believe. Gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience. With that, let's pray. Father in heaven, Lord, I pray these next few days, weeks, and years, you would help us to be diligent in submitting to your Holy Spirit work within us, that we may grow in gentleness and in respect of one another. Help us to listen to one another rather than just thinking of good comebacks, but to really pay attention and to give careful respect to those who may oppose us, to those who have different insights. Give us the humility, Lord, that we'd be willing to learn from one another. And then finally, Lord, help us to seek a clear conscience, that when we're wrong, we would admit that we're wrong. Where sin and pride has gotten away, we'd be willing to admit that we're wrong there and repent of that as well. So help all of us to grow in these three things, Father. And we thank you, too, for the special privilege of being alive in the 21st century, when there are so many new reasons to believe in you as Creator, Lord, and Savior. So make us fruitful, Lord, as by your Spirit we find these opportunities and begin to give an answer for the hope within us. In Jesus' name, amen.